Shall we suggest, whoever would like, you would certainly be welcome to come closer this way. I kind of feel like some of you are way down far reaches of a long tunnel. So, as you are comfortable, but you're welcome to come out more this way. Okay. Let's see. Who has been here on yesterday and the day before? Okay. And who was here yesterday? Okay. So several of you are coming for the first time to what we have been doing. So this is a bit of a challenge because I like to do, when I do a seminar, I like to do it as a seminar, which means there's some continuity. But alas, this is not something we can always get in this world. This being the world that it is. But we're very happy that all of you who have come, so do feel welcome. And all I will say is that I will sometimes be speaking in a way that might not always make complete sense because I may be continuing from something I said the last two days. On the other hand, it's Bhagavatam, and I think I'm guessing all or most of you are more or less familiar with the Bhagavatam. And one of the points we have made about the Bhagavatam is that we can go on reading it throughout our lifetimes. When we come to the end, Canto 12, we can start right over with Canto 1. And indeed, Canto 1 is especially important, and that's why we're discussing it, as the introduction, as the overture, as the setting the stage for what we might call the Bhagavatam proper, beginning with chapter 1 in Canto 2. And although I had originally thought to move a bit faster, we would have already been starting with Canto 2 today, I decided, what's the rush? There's no rush. And so now we are on chapter 16, how Parikshit received the age of Kali. And before I speak further, let us invoke the Lord as Vasudeva. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Yes, this is a very nice mantra, which appears also in Canto 4. Dhruva Maharaj becomes initiated into this mantra by Narada Muni. Another initiation story. I was speaking yesterday about how you find different initiations, and Maharaj Parikshit is a very special case of spiritual initiation taking place before he is born and getting the direct darshan of the Lord. Now that a special initiation. In chapter 12, we have that account of Maharaj Parikshit's appearance taking place in the midst of great political turmoil. We discussed how also the Bhagavatam is, and especially the first canto, is a sort of commentary to the Mahabharata. It's also a kind of sequel to the Mahabharata. And as we all know, the Mahabharata is the story of a great war. And the war doesn't really end with the end of the war, because Ashwatthama thinks that he has to annihilate the entire dynasty. His attempt is successful with the sons of Draupadi, but his attempt fails with Parikshit, the grandson, the one grandson of Arjuna. Parikshit survives. He is the one remaining descendant of the Pandavas to carry on the dynastic line, which is of such great concern among kings. Kings are always worried about having a son to continue their line. And this comes up later with King Chitraketu. He's very, very much in anxiety. And eventually he gets his child, but he loses his child soon after that. By intrigue, by murder. There's a lot of violence in the Mahabharata and also in the Bhagavatam. Scholars of religion often notice how much violence there is connected with religion, which leads many to conclude that if we could get rid of religion, we could get rid of violence. That is bad logic. Most of the violence takes place in the name of religion and in the lower modes of material nature. Well, that's another subject, but we may come back to it. In relation to Parikshit Maharaj, scholars of religion with whom I've had a fair amount to do in recent years, that's why I sometimes refer to that species, they will also say that religion and politics are two sides of the same coin. That you don't get the one without the other. And in this analogy of the coin means value. What is it that is of ultimate value is the question of religion. And what is of value in this world is the question, and how do we get it is the question of politics. Maharaj Parikshit is a king. So he's very much involved in politics. And this comes out in this chapter, chapter 16, how Maharaj Parikshit received the age of Kali. Notice Prabhupada's title for this chapter, how he received the age of Kali. As we've discussed the last 2 days, one of the motifs that comes frequently in the Bhagavatam is reception, hosting, how one is received by another, how one is welcomed or not welcomed, and the various consequences of these. So Maharaj Parikshit is going to receive the age of Kali in a very special way. Verse number 4, as I'm doing an overview, I'm just dropping into specific verses not trying to be completely comprehensive, but to highlight certain points. Verse number 4. Once, when Maharaj Parikshit was on his way to conquer the world, he saw the master of Kali Yuga, who was lower than a Shudra, disguised as a king and hurting the legs of a cow and bull. The king at once caught hold of him to deal sufficient punishment. Now here's a case where it's useful to take note of the Sanskrit. Prabhupada has given us the Devanagari script, Sanskrit, for those of you who can read Devanagari. And he's given Roman transliterations, and then he's given word-for-word translations. Many of these were done in later cantos with the help of many of the word-for-word were done by Pradyumna Prabhu, who lives in New York and is a very knowledgeable Sanskritist, and he continues to the present day to study our literature. Especially he likes to study the commentaries of the Acharyas. His favorite is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So here I wanted to just point out Nijagraho jasavira kalin digvijaye kvachit nripa linga dharam shudram nantam go mitunam pada. First of all, digvijaye, for the purpose of conquering all the directions. Maharaj Parikshit is the king, and he perceives the need to re-establish religion because the Lord Krishna has departed. Already the signs of Kali are trickling in and pervading his kingdom. So he sees the need to go out and re-establish the principles, and also for protection of society. But what does he see? Nripa linga dhara shudra. He sees a shudra, a low-class person, appearing like a king, disguised as a king. So this is one of the motifs, you could say, of the Bhagavatam is authenticity versus appearance, false appearance. This will come up again, especially in, Canto 4, yeah. Later in Canto 4, Prithu Maharaj is offering sacrifice after sacrifice after sacrifice. That's what kings do. He's counting. He's got a clicker, maybe. One sacrifice, two. He's got 99. He's done 99 horse sacrifices. Click, click, click. And he wants to do one more. Because, why? Because Indra, heavenly king, the king of heaven, Indra, he has done 100. So Prithu wants to also do 100 because it's a good number. But Indra doesn't like that idea. Indra always has a kind of insecurity complex. And he's always afraid of losing his position, and he's afraid that he's going to lose his position to Prithu. So he's not going to let him also do 100 sacrifices. What to do? Well, the logical thing to do is steal the horse. If you don't have a horse, you can't do a sacrifice. And in order to protect himself from the consequences of his horse stealing, horse wrangling, he disguises himself. And he disguises himself as a religious person, as an ascetic, as a sannyasi. And what is the result of that? The result is that there is an upa sampradaya created, a group, some group of inauthentic ascetics. They see Indra and they say, well, if he can do it, we can also do it. So following his example, yat yat acharati sheshtas tat tat eya purojana, sa yat pramanam kurute lokas tat anavartate. It goes both ways. If you have a good leader, you'll get good following. If you have a rascal leader, you'll get rascal following. Shishi Radha Gopi Vallabha Ki. So here we have a false king and a real king. We have a false someone in disguise appearing as. And of course, the Bhagavatam is very much concerned with reality versus appearance. And when Vyasadev, in beginning of chapter 5 of this canto, sits down to meditate, having been inspired by Narada to do so, what does he see? He sees two things. He sees Krishna, the reality, and he sees the shadow, he sees Maya. He sees both, and he sees the distinction between the two. So one of the big lessons of the Bhagavatam, because the Bhagavatam is very much a didactic work. It's teaching us things. One of the things it's teaching us is how to distinguish between reality and illusion. You think it's a good idea to be able to tell the difference? What do you think? No? I like illusion. Yeah? What do you think? Is it good to learn? Good to learn. Okay. Yeah, it's good to learn. It can be the difference between between spiritual life and material life. It can be the difference between becoming free, becoming joyful, and becoming just further entangled in this world. Suffering. Okay, so we have this scene, and then a few verses later, we get a sort of interlude. Let's see. Okay, then something a little bit strange happens, and often devotees don't quite notice what's happening. But I'll start with verse 17 and then 18. Now you may hear from me. Who is me? Anyone know who is speaking here? Anyone want to guess? Somebody is speaking. Yes. No, you're a couple of cantos early. Maitreya is going to appear in Canto 3. No. Who is speaking in most of Canto 1? I'll give you a hint. It's not Shukadeva Goswami. Why? Because he hasn't appeared yet. So who would it be? Hmm?
Sankara. How about Lord Shri Krishna?
No, we don't have Krishna speaking here. Hmm? Yes, Sutta Goswami is speaking. And who is he speaking to? He's speaking to a big crowd of sages. And where is this happening? Nainisharanya. I've never been there myself. Anyone's been to Nainisharanya? Yeah? Nice place?
Yeah.
Okay.
Huh? Very nice and safe.
Nice, okay. Yeah, I like to go there sometimes. Yeah, so he's speaking to them, they're all listening, and he says, now you may hear from me of what happens while Maharaj Parikshit was passing his days hearing of the good occupations of his forefathers and being absorbed in thought of them. So it's been describing how he's heard of his great forefathers, especially Arjuna, all these great Pandava heroes. And he's inspired by all this. So he's listening to that. But then, verse 18, the personality of religious principles, Dharma, was wandering about in the form of a bull, and he met the personality of earth in the form of a cow who appeared to grieve like a mother who had lost her child. She had tears in her eyes and the beauty of her body was lost. Thus, Dharma questioned the earth as follows. And then we get his questioning, why are you, what's happened to you? How has this situation come upon you? Now, the point I want to make, though, is it seems to me that what we're dealing with here is what's called an allegory. Y'all know what an allegory is? Anybody? Huh?
An allegory is a story to symbolize meaning and to teach an object lesson.
Oh, wow. That sounds like straight out of the dictionary. Okay. Allegories typically have personifications of abstract principles. So, what do we have here? We have Dharma, the principle of religion, Dharma. And he is appearing in the form of a bull. And he's meeting Earth. You could say, well, Earth is not exactly abstract, but in a certain sense, Earth is abstract because we never really comprehend the whole Earth. And Earth is appearing in the form of a cow. Later, in Canto 4, Narada will be giving a lesson to one king with a very interesting name, Prachinavarhishat. And he's going to also speak an allegory, but in that case, he's going to say very explicitly, now I'm going to teach you something with an allegory. Here we don't get that. It's just for us to pick up. Why does that matter? Maybe it doesn't matter, but I find that if we don't recognize it as an allegory, it gets a little confusing. And it does get a little complicated because then we have the personified age of Kali in the form of this disguised Shudra. What's going on here? Well, and then we have the actual king, Parikshit, encountering all of this. So we get this very interesting blend of registers of narrative. But of course, the main idea, well, there's a few main ideas, but one is we have this great king. He's a religious king, and he wants to ensure that his kingdom is protected. But in his concern to act properly as a king, something highly ironic happens. Well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Let's go to the next chapter. The next chapter is called Punishment and Reward of Kali. So this is where Maharaj Parikshit and the personality Kali meet. Verse number 5. Kastam macharane loke balat dansya balan bali naradevo si veshena natavat karmana advija. Advija. What means dvija? I know you know what is dvija. What is it? Twice born. Dvija. Right? Means what? Twice born. Means? Can mean initiated, yes. Can also mean brahmana. Can also mean bird. Birds are born twice. Once from an egg and then from the egg. Yeah, that's a dvija. But here we have a dvija, which would mean? Huh? Never born? No, not never born. It means simply not twice born, which means once born. yes. Okay, translation. Oh, who are you? You appear to be strong, and yet you dare kill within my protection those who are helpless? By your dress, you pose yourself to be a godly man, a king. But by your deeds, you are opposing the principle of the twice-born Kshatriyas. Of course, this is Maharaj Parikshit is addressing Kali. You rogue, do you dare? There's a little too much echo, I think. Do you dare beat an innocent cow? Because Lord Krishna and Arjuna, the carrier of the Gandiva bow, are out of sight? Since you are beating the innocent in a secluded place, you are considered a culprit and therefore deserve to be killed. Now, in a sense, this brings me to another subject which I was asked to talk about yesterday. Maybe we can blend these a little bit. Except, there's one problem, and that is Vanamali Pandit Prabhu is not here, and he's the one who asked me to do this. He's busy managing things. So maybe I should wait till he's back. But I don't know if he's coming back. What to do? It's recorded. Yeah, but... Yeah. Anyway, so he's asking a rhetorical question here. What's a rhetorical question? Yeah, it can include the answer in the question, but it's not looking for an answer, is it? It's not a question that you answer, it's a kind of statement. Ah, there you are. Right. Since you were asking for this discussion of the bells, the eight bells, so I thought you might want to be here, if you're free. So, yeah, I had mentioned yesterday that I made a little list of what I call bells, of active reading, not just for the Bhagavatam, for any of Prabhupada's books. As we say in English, that rings a bell, right? We still have that saying in English. Sometimes, you know, I'm away from this country so many years, but I come back, there's different ways of saying things, and I'm never quite sure. So the first of these I call the connection bell. The connection bell is, oh, that reminds me of X, Y, or Z, something else in the scriptures. There is, in the medieval Christian European tradition, a practice which they call Lectio Divina. In the monasteries, the monks would practice Lectio Divina. They would study, they would read, they would memorize so many passages from their scriptures, the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament. They would learn these scriptures so well that they could quote different passages for hours. And they would read a passage and they would think, oh yes, this reminds me of. And then they would jump to that passage and they would quote that passage. And they would converse in this way. And in this way they would enliven each other. Matchitta matkata prana bodhayanta parasparam. Krishna says, so this is the system, enlivening each other. One way of this enlivening is to remember Shastra and be reminded. So just now I'm reading this and I'm reminded that we have just heard previously from an earlier chapter, Arjuna lamenting the loss, the disappearance of Krishna, and feeling helpless. And what does he say there? We read this wonderful verse. I am the same Arjuna. I have the same Gandiva Go. And he goes on and on like that. Everything is the same except one thing. And what is that one thing? Krishna has left. And therefore, he says, it is all useless. Everything I try to do is like, it's like putting oblations on ashes. And so on. Now we have Maharaj Parikshit saying, hey, you rascal, are you acting in this way because Krishna and Arjuna are absent? You're thinking you can take advantage of this situation? Because you are acting in this way, he concludes, you deserve to be killed. Praharam vadam arhasi. Now that could remind us of something else that we discussed, namely the situation of Arjuna standing between Krishna and Draupadi to decide how to deal with Ashwatthama after he has murdered the five children of Draupadi. He was told to kill Ashwatthama, and he was told not to kill Ashwatthama. And he was told, you have to satisfy both orders. And so, what does he do? Very cleverly, he kills Ashwatthama socially by taking off his crown jewels, cutting off his hair, and casting him out. He becomes an outcast. People in India are very caste conscious, and people in the West don't really understand how grave it could be for one's social life, for one's life, to be cast out of one's caste, of one's jati. It's not so much the case for urbanites in India, but for people in the villages, still it can be extremely important. My point here being that this conclusion of Maharaj Parikshit, you deserve to be killed. He's making a judgment, and Arjuna had to make a judgment. And so, very broadly, I think one of the subjects of the Bhagavatam is, how do we make choices? How do we make choices? On what basis do we make? We have to make choices in our lives as we go through our lives. We have to make so many choices. To become more conscious of choice making, is making it possible to make better choices. Sometimes we may just, by not making a choice, then life makes a choice for us, and then we're not happy. So Parikshit Maharaj decides, as the king, he has a responsibility. Well, this could go into a whole other subject, and that is the issue of capital punishment. It seems that the Bhagavatam endorses capital punishment. I just saw something on the internet yesterday. How much it costs the state to deal with one case of capital punishment is actually considerably more than what it is to put that person in prison for life. It costs something, an average of over $300 million to process one case of capital punishment. So just in economics, one might wonder if that's really the way to go in the modern state. Anyway, that's another subject. So Maharaj Parikshit makes this decision, but what's going to happen? Kali is going to take shelter of him. He's going to throw off his disguise and say, I'm just a shudra now, please. Save me. Please protect me. See, what did I make? I'm sort of jumping here. Maharaj Parikshit also encounters the bull. The sequence of events in these chapters is sometimes a little... Well, I can only say what's happening is a summary of what we're probably to understand has happened. And I explained that also yesterday. The Bhagavatam as a whole is a summary of so much from other Puranas, from the Mahabharata. And so sometimes it's a little bit unclear how things are following one from another. But at one point, Maharaj Parikshit interviews the bull, personified Dharma. Seeing that, he has been maltreated. He has lost 3 out of 4 of his legs, the 4 legs of Dharma. 3 of them are lost. And this is a bull able to speak, and he speaks Sanskrit. Why not? Not just any language, but purified. The word Sanskrit means purified. Sanskrita. So Dharma Uvacha Etatva. He's asking him, how did this happen to you? What was the cause? And this echoes back. It goes back to the very first verse of the Bhagavatam. Janmadyasya yatumvayat itratas charte shravayinyasvarat. Getting a little wild out there. The number one sort of philosophical issue in the Bhagavatam is what is the cause of anything? And of course, the ultimate cause is Krishna. But here, very interesting, Dharma is asked, how is this? Who did this to you? What's the cause? Dharma refuses to point his finger at anyone. He says, you're asking a very nice question. And then he says in verse 18, chapter 17, it is very difficult to ascertain the particular miscreant who has caused our suffering, because we are bewildered by all the different opinions of theoretical philosophers. Some of the philosophers who deny all sorts of duality declare that one's own self is responsible for one's personal happiness and distress. Others say that superhuman powers are responsible. Well, yet others say that activity is responsible, karma. And the gross materialists maintain that nature, svabhava, is the ultimate cause. And he goes on, there are also some thinkers who believe that no one can ascertain the cause of distress by argumentation, nor know it by imagination, nor express it by words. O sage amongst kings, judge for yourself by thinking over all this with your own intelligence. He's not going to say who's doing it. He's not going to say, it's this rascal Kali. No, he says, well, different sages say different things, and there's different philosophies, and some people say you can't really say. So you decide. Now, this also echoes back to a discussion in Chapter 9 of this same canto. In Chapter 9, we have Yudhishthira speaking with... Anybody know who? No. He's speaking with Bhishma. And Bhishma is about to leave his body. And Bhishma is amazed. He's expressing his amazement at what the Pandavas have had to endure. And as I was saying, in the Bhagavatam, everybody is coming out on the stage after the performance and showing their real identity. So Bhishma, who is he? He's actually Krishna's pure devotee. Krishna is present at the side of Bhishma as Bhishma is speaking to Yudhishthira. And what is Bhishma saying? He's saying, this is really very mysterious. How is it that all of this happened to you? What is the cause? Well, some will say that it's time, and some will say that it's karma, and some will say that it's this, and some will say that it's that. And he's kind of talking around in circles, and Krishna is right there. And finally, Bhishma says, all of this is due to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He doesn't say Krishna, the Supreme Personality of God. Ultimately, he is sanctioned. So similarly here, but he's not even going that far to say, ultimately, it's the Lord. He's just saying, well, it's different opinions. And this may remind us that the Bhagavatam also is a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. The Vedanta Sutra has some 550 sutras giving very compact sutra form teachings about the essence of the Upanishads. And in the second of four chapters of the Vedanta Sutra, various theories which are rejected by the Vedanta Sutra are presented and then refuted. And so that's being echoed here. Except that Dharma is not making any commitment. So then the king replies to this and he says, oh, you who are in the form of a bull, you know the truth of religion and you are speaking according to the principle that the destination intended for the perpetrator of irreligious acts is also intended for one who identifies the perpetrator. You are no other than the personality of religion. Isn't that interesting? If one points the finger, one points at someone who has committed a crime, one is implicated oneself in that crime. How can you run a state on that principle. And yet, we understand Maharaj Pariksit is the embodiment of religious principles, and he's pointing to personification of religious principles and saying, this proves that you are personified religion. That's interesting. And this discussion concludes with Pariksit Maharaj saying, thus it is concluded that the Lord's energies are inconceivable. No one can estimate them by mental speculation or by word jugglery. Prabhupada's translation, word jugglery. What's it translating here? In any case, so it's all about the inconceivable energies of the Lord. Now, all of this is, all this kind of philosophical discussion is happening in the context of a very dramatic moment, right? And what is the dramatic moment? We have this confrontation between a real king and a false king. And the real king says, you have to be killed. Why is he to be killed? Not because of his disguise, but because of his acts of abuse against the cow and the bull, which is abuse against civilization. But, as I said, then what happens, then the personified Kali, he throws himself at the feet of Pariksit and takes shelter of him. And the king understands, oh, as a king I have to give him shelter. He's surrendered. And so by the rules of Kshatriyas, if someone surrenders to you, you cannot, you know, just ignore the surrender and kill them. That would be as much a crime as anything else that the criminal had done. This is a very, how to say, lively temple. There's all kinds of things going on inside and outside. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, so Maharaj Pariksit finds himself sort of cornered in a way. And this is interesting from the perspective of considering just what is Dharma? And this is the big question of the Mahabharata, what is Dharma? In the end, the only conclusion we get in the Mahabharata is Krishna's statement at the end of the Gita, Sarva Dharman Prityaja. Mamekam Sharanam Raja. Forget about Dharma and just surrender to me. Because the complexities of Dharma are such that you're never going to get it straight. You're never going to get it worked out in such a way that what you do will indeed be the right thing. And what another person does is indeed the right thing. Best is you just kind of put all of that aside and surrender to me. Okay, but how to do that? As Prabhupada says, Bhagavad Gita is the ABCs, and at the end it says, surrender to me. How to do that? That's Bhagavatam. But Bhagavatam is a lot bigger, it's a lot longer than Bhagavad Gita, so that means that you have to really hunker down and get really attentive to catch the message of how to do that. Yeah. verse number 38. Suta Goswami said Maharaj Parikshit, thus being petitioned by the personality of Godhead, gave him permission to reside in places where gambling, drinking, prostitution, and animal slaughter were performed. Okay, but personality of Kali is going to ask for something more. He says, because of his begging, the king gave him permission to live where there is gold. Because wherever there is gold, there is also falsity, intoxication, lust, envy, and enmity. So where is gold kept? In the bank. Actually, they don't keep any gold. They don't have any gold, they just have computers and computer screens and there's no, it's not even real gold, it's false gold. And stocks and bonds and derivatives. Wow, that's where it gets scary. Derivatives and hedge funds. People making money on the basis of other people losing money. All of these dark things are going on. One devotee who was quite experienced in trading on the stock market. In fact, I think he wrote a book about it. I asked him once, but isn't this gambling? And he said, no, it's not gambling if you know what you're doing. If you don't know what you're doing, it's gambling. And if you know what you're doing, it's not gambling. Now, where's the line between the two? We might ask that about ourselves in general. Where's the line between taking risk? How are you going to live without risk taking? How are you going to do any business without some risk taking? How are you going to share your life with another person without taking the risk of entrusting yourself to the other person? Interesting subjects. Well, all right, here we have one way of looking at this whole story of the appearance of Kali is it's an etiological story. What's an etiological story? It's a story which explains why a certain phenomenon is the way it is. An example, according to some version of the Ramayana, I'm not sure if it's Valmiki or another one, but there's some little episode, the story is. We sometimes hear that it's a spider that was helping to build the bridge, and sometimes we hear it's a squirrel that was helping to build the bridge to Lanka. Different versions. There's countless versions of Ramayana. But in the story of the squirrel, as I have heard, iti shushuma viranam, having heard from the Devas. Lord Ram was pleased with the service, however small it was, of the squirrel, and he stroked that squirrel on his back with two fingers. And what was the result of his stroking? Now all squirrels have two stripes on their backs. That is an etiological story to explain the stripes on the backs of squirrels. So in case anyone ever asks you, why do squirrels have stripes on their backs? You know the answer. And should anyone doubt the truth of this, you can say, you are questioning Ramachandra, the Supreme Lord. Anyway, so this story, this account, Sometimes I'll use the word story and devotees will get nervous. Oh, you're saying that that's just some fiction? Because Prabhupada was adamant that this is not fiction, this is history, it's not myth. No, I'm just using the word in the general sense of narrative. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Something happens, and there's some sort of plot. And typically there's some dramatic element, which means there's some kind of conflict also. Well,